what we're talking about is the disease, not the person. We try to focus in on that language piece, and we try to say the person has obesity rather than the person is obese. Because we don't say the person is cancerous. We say they have cancer.
Welcome to the Good Clean Nutrition Podcast. I'm your host, Ginger Holton, an integrative registered dietitian nutritionist. Before we begin, I want to take a moment to thank Colleen Webb. She left a really kind review about the show, and that goes a long way in helping other people find us and get that great nutrition and health advice that is so important for your life, really. I appreciate it a lot. It's actually really easy to do. Wherever you happen to be listening to your podcast, you can go to the review section and leave a star rating. If you want to take it one small step further, I would love to hear your feedback. You can just drop me a quick review. Today, I'm talking to Dr. Jamie Ard. He's a clinical researcher focused on studying strategies to treat obesity in adults. He co-directs the Wake Forest Baptist Health Weight Management Center, where he oversees medical weight management programs. In the first part of the series, we're doing a big overview on obesity, covering definitions and bias, what the clinical research says about the disease and nutrition treatment versus pharmaceutical treatment. There's a lot to cover today. Welcome, Dr. Ard. I'm so excited to talk to you today.
Thank you. Glad to be here. I appreciate the opportunity.
What is your role as an obesity medicine specialist?
We work in a team setting, so I have dietitians like yourself, exercise physiologists, behavioral health providers, and then we have a medical provider team, and then we also have our surgical team, since we do the broad comprehensive treatment of obesity in our center. So the medical provider role within our team is really someone who helps to direct the overall treatment plan and identify with a patient health goals that we want to try to achieve. And when it comes to pharmacotherapy and use of pharmacotherapy prescribed for the treatment of obesity, when we feel like that is appropriate as part of the treatment plan.
I actually wanted to start with some language and verbiage, including definitions of overweight, obesity, even obesity bias. And what I've found in my work is these words are really emotionally charged.
There's a lot of meaning wrapped up in that is emotional for a lot of people. When you talk about, what do we mean when we say overweight and obesity? Let's just start using those together for right now, just to define that, right? Because the fundamental basis for that is really the metric of body mass index, BMI. That becomes a challenging issue in and of itself in terms of how we think about that. But when we clinically document in a chart that someone has overweight or that they have obesity, then what we are suggesting with that is that at some point we've said based on their height, they have an excess amount of weight. And if we were to use the calculation of body mass index, 25 and higher to 29.9 is considered in the overweight category, and 30 and higher is considered in the obesity category. So those are the basic metric-based definitions of overweight and obesity, and they're on a continuum. Now, when we think about clinically, do we diagnose obesity simply based on a BMI number, a calculation? The answer is no. So body mass index is really just a screening tool. It's a way for us to say, hey, we should probably check to determine, does this person have some type of excess body fat that is leading to some health consequence? We want to know, is that fundamentally a result of energy imbalance, a dysfunction of how the body regulates energy balance? So that explanation suggests that obesity and overweight are not just a BMI calculation. You have to have the other components in order to really be able to diagnose that this is abnormal excess body weight that is causing harm to health, and that it is a function of some type of disruption in how the brain manages energy. That's the way we want to think about that. And then if we meet those definitions, those criteria for saying, yes, this is obesity, now we're saying this is a chronic disease. It's a disease. It's not a character flaw. It's not a lack of discipline or self-control. It is not the fault of the individual. It is a chronic disease. And that's why I go back to the dysregulation of energy balance with abnormal body fat that leads to abnormal health consequences.
You are just going so far beyond some numbers on a piece of paper or just looking at this height-weight ratio and saying, you're in this category, have a nice day. And it just expands it so much to who's in front of me. Who are they? What are their risk factors? What is their life like? How do I help them right now at this moment in time?
Yeah, because the problem that we've gotten ourselves into is that we've taken body mass index and we've put it into clinical practice in ways that it wasn't really meant to be put into clinical practice. And it's a great epidemiologic tool. It describes body size across a population, but that's all it does. It does not diagnose the disease of obesity. That takes an additional assessment. And so we are trying to rethink and reformulate how we communicate about this issue. Because as you mentioned, when you're talking to your patients and they have this emotional burden wrapped up in that word, it comes from this stigma that ends up getting wrapped in there just because we've taken a very simplistic view of what obesity is.
Yeah. It's really refreshing for me to hear you break it down like that. My clients will say things like, I just need to be more motivated. I just need to have better willpower. They take on this responsibility. But what I'm hearing from you is it's so much more than that. And this is where we really start to get into health disparities too.
We think obesity is because individuals have a lack of willpower and discipline in that they fundamentally are greedy and lazy. This is what some people will say. Well, if we look at the population and we say, well, Black women, African-American women have the highest rate of obesity in the U.S. compared to other race sex groups. Are we then saying that Black women are, by definition, more lazy and more greedy than anybody else? I mean, that's what we would have to say if we think this is an individual level driven disease. And I don't know anyone who would want to go out on that limb and say that Black women are lazy. So it just doesn't pass the sniff test. And you just have to back out of that and say, okay, that makes no sense to say that group of people all have the same character trait. If we do that, if we back out of that, and then we start to say, well, okay, well, what could it be that is affecting one population, one group of people in a certain way that biologically we can't just chalk it up to skin color, because that's not a biological phenomenon that is relevant in this case. So then we'd have to start to think about, well, okay, what else might be happening that leads to this disproportionate dysregulation of energy balance with abnormal fat that leads to health consequences? Well, the way I tend to explain it is that certain groups of people are more exposed to our obesogenic environment. What do I mean by obesogenic? We live in an environment now that if you just go about doing your daily work, taking care of your family, successful in your career, if you aren't careful, you will find that the forces within our normal environment push you towards weight gain. We have unprecedented access to very palatable, tasty food that's got lots of calories in small packages. We don't have to be physically active, not in the same way that our grandparents used to be or our great-grandparents used to have to be. They had to walk to school or to work or to get to the grocery store. I have a phone. I can order food for you wherever you are, right? Like, when in history could we do that? The balance of how we have to spend our energy in the environment just to survive, that's changed dramatically in the past several decades. And it's continuing to get easier for us to exist without having to expend energy. And then you also have other systemic issues that limit access to healthy items, that limit access to safe places for physical activity, that have an impact on education and income, where you live. And when you start to pile all those things up together, you start to realize, yeah, one group of people might be more adversely affected by a number of those things than other groups of people. That group of people gets a bigger dose of the obesogenic environment, and other people may get small doses of the obesogenic environment, and they have relative protection. They have other resources that they can call upon in order to protect them from that environment. It's like a coal miner and his family. The coal miner is likely to get black lung because he's going down in the coal mine every day. Family members are not going to get black lung because they don't have to go in the coal mine. They might have to deal with the dust that he brings home, but that exposure is very different. So we got a lot of people going down into the coal mine who are living in poor resource areas. And in our country, with our history, that often means these are people of color who are dealing disproportionately with that level of obesogenic environment. And that explains much better than saying, oh, yeah, this group of people, they don't care about their health.
Right. Like this gigantic groups, a million of people all have the same personality trait. It makes no sense. When you mention the obesogenic environment and you talk about highly palatable foods, are you thinking about sugar-sweetened beverages, excess sodium, saturated fat, just calories in general? How do you think about that as a physician?
This optimal combination of salt, fat, and sugar in a given product to make your brain say, that was amazing. And if one was great, two will be better. And so that's a real thing. It's not happenstance that the potato chips always look the same and taste the same. They're designed to be that way. And food can be a very reliable drug. I know when I open that pack of M&Ms, the first one's going to taste like the last one. And whether I get it in Seattle or I get it in Winston-Salem, they're going to be the same. And there's not much in nature that is that way. You bite into one apple, it may taste a little sweeter. The next one may not taste as sweet. Nature doesn't produce that level of consistency. So we're faced with some real scientific advancement when it comes to these types of food products.
I never thought about the consistency and replicability of food being so comforting and attractive. But one thing I do talk to my clients all the time about, because they feel bad that they want these foods that are so highly palatable. But the way that I often describe it is, in the wild, let's say you didn't have access to these kind of foods, if you could get your hands on salt or a high fat food or a high calorie food or sugar, you're biologically driven to want that and to seek it out. And it makes your brain feel good and it helps you survive. So it's not really your fault that you seek that. It really is just biological.
Yeah, I've seen anthropologists who study food ways of early civilization and groups of people who are still subsistence farmers or really not in the same society that we are in terms of mechanization and so forth. And it's really remarkable to look at the number of calories that they consume in given periods, right? If they find a honeycomb, they will eat a lot of honey all at once. Like, it's just an amazing amount of honey that they might eat at one time, but it's the only time they're going to get honey for months. But yeah, you're right. Like, they are so driven to say, yeah, I'm going to eat as much of this as I can. And then they move on. It's not like they're constantly seeking honey. They move on and they're very lean, but the core of their diet and what they subsist on is what they can grow and forage and capture. It's not the same density of calories that we get. And so that is really, really remarkable to see. Like, that's where we came from and how much it's changed in just a short period of time.
But now we live in this environment where we're presented new and different challenges, like you outlined. So let's say somebody is obese, falls into that BMI category. What, from your research, is the health risk? How do you assess that when someone has excess body fat?
We think about it as the individual has obesity. And what we want to do is we want to determine what are the consequences of that excess body fat. And the consequences of the excess body fat are often based on the location of the body fat. You can think about the body as being a container for muscle and fat and bone. And when we consume extra calories, that those extra calories get stored as fat. And our container has compartments for fat. The main compartment is actually under the skin. That's what we call subcutaneous fat. And that's where it's least harmful from a metabolic standpoint, from a cardiovascular, diabetes, cancer, all those risks. So if you can put fat under the skin efficiently and effectively, you might have obesity, but you might have really normal labs, like your cholesterol will be normal, your blood pressure might be normal, but you might have sleep apnea, for example, or you might have arthritis of your knees or your back or your hips because you are carrying extra weight, and that mechanical load does have an impact. So metabolically, we might say you have metabolically healthy obesity, but you might have physically some challenges. Now, if you put that extra fat in and around your organs in the midsection, that becomes really challenging in terms of health, because now you're talking about increasing inflammation, increasing insulin levels. These are all bad things that are part of a cascade. And you can put fat in the liver. You can put fat around the heart. You can put fat around the kidneys, around the intestine, any of those areas, bad outcomes. And so that's what we want to avoid. We want to treat aggressively. So what are we looking for laboratory-wise? Like, we might look at liver function tests to see, do you have an elevated liver enzymes like AST, ALT? We can look at the liver in terms of ultrasound or CT scans to see, do you have fat deposition in the liver? We look at fasting insulin levels, for example, in our clinic, or hemoglobin A1C, look at your long-range blood glucose test. So those are some of the assessments that we can look at. Cholesterol levels are actually useful. Triglyceride levels in particular can be useful. The relationship between good cholesterol, your HDL, and your bad cholesterol, those can be very useful in terms of thinking about what we assess and how we categorize risk. Blood pressure is important to understand and the impact that excess weight can have there as well.
Are you familiar with, and how do you feel about, the Health at Every Size movement?
We do talk about it. Fundamentally, when we talk about obesity, what we're talking about is the disease, not the person. So that's why we try to focus in on that language piece, and we try to say the person has obesity rather than the person is obese. Because we don't say the person is cancerous. We say they have cancer. We're separating the disease from the person. When we're talking about this, we're not suggesting that just because you have a larger body, that's a bad thing. So that goes back to the beginning of the conversation, where we're actually saying, if you have obesity, it's because of these criteria, not just because of body size. And then the last piece of this is that there's been this sort of implicit message that we're trying to get people to be thin. And treating obesity is not about trying to get people to be thin. It's trying to improve health. And you don't have to be thin in order to be healthy. So we see a lot of our patients who find new health and find lots of improvement in their health, but they are not at a BMI below 25. They might still have a BMI of 35 or 40 even, but they've made significant health improvements and they are on a journey towards maintaining or achieving that ideal health. And we want for that health benefit to be as bountiful as possible. As much as health as they can acquire, we want to achieve that. If that means they need to lose weight to a certain target in order to be able to bend down and pick up their grandchild, then who am I to say that they shouldn't be able to do that? And my goal as a clinician is to help them achieve their goals. So the idea that you can be healthy at every size, agree. But we want to have the patient have the autonomy to say, yeah, I feel that my body is healthier at this size, and I would like to have help to get to that point. That's totally up to that patient, and that's what we're here for.
I practice really similarly. I don't say, oh, you know, you have to be this BMI or this size, but let's look at all your labs. Let's look at your goals, and also believing people.
Yeah.
And what the story that they're telling you is really important. I like this personalized approach that you take. It's exactly how I practice.
We want our patients to feel heard. There's often nothing more frustrating for our patients than their experience of not feeling heard or seen in the healthcare system. And I'm sure you see the same when you finally just stop and listen to people and acknowledge their presence and their experience and what their truth is. That totally changes the relationship that you have with the patient. And then they're much more open to hearing what you have to say then at that point, because otherwise they've just been talked to their whole life in the healthcare system and probably in other aspects of life.
Yeah, there is weight bias in our healthcare system with physicians, with dietitians for sure. And then I always find it challenging to pull apart the health risks from excess body fat, and when somebody's struggling with maybe the negative cultural experiences they're getting from weight bias. How do you help pull that apart?
It's hard. Often we don't try to totally disentangle it because we know that issues like depression, anxiety often go in the same circles with obesity. And some of that may be because of the bias that people feel and experience and the stigma that they may have internalized over time. But on the flip side, we also find that a lot of times people put their hope on, I will feel better about myself with treatment. And I always caution people and say, it's not always that easy. The thing that you've been reaching for in terms of a smaller body size, that may come, but it may not lead to the life-altering perspective that you were looking for. It won't change the bad relationship that you have. It won't change the crazy job and boss that you have. Some of those things are not connected to body size. And that's where that disentanglement piece can be really helpful, because then you sort of help people segment some of these things and put them in buckets to adequately address them and say, yeah, that's a bad relationship and you need to not be in that relationship. And just because you lose weight doesn't change the dynamic of that relationship, may make it worse in some cases. I'm sure you've got plenty of stories like that that we do too, where you see things go sideways because someone lost weight and the other person in the relationship just doesn't deal with it well.
Orgain's all-in-one nutrition shakes are formulated for everyday nutrition and cater to a variety of health needs and conditions. Available in dairy and plant-based options, these shakes have been carefully crafted to deliver 16 grams of high-quality protein, along with up to 22 essential vitamins and minerals, and a wholesome blend of organic fruits and veggies. For little ones, Orgain offers plant and dairy-based organic kids shakes balanced with 8 grams of protein, essential nutrients, and a delicious mix of fruits and veggies. Even the pickiest kids will be asking for more. Take charge of your health and the well-being of others with Orgain. Visit Orgain.com today to explore the full range of products. When people come to me, because I'm a dietitian, and they say, I want you to help me lose weight, I often will say, if you've got other health stuff, I'd really like to go after that. And we'll see how the weight follows. Some people want to hear that and some people don't. But in my application form to work with me the other day, somebody wrote, I want to lose weight. And then it's like, why? And she wrote, so I can be a happier person. And I was like, I need to talk to this person when I first meet her and say, that's not how I practice. And that hasn't been my lived experience with folks. But there's a lot of other really cool stuff we can do. And you might feel better as a result of those things.
Yeah. It just really highlights the challenge of what our patients deal with and the complexity of this disease state, in that you have all of these negative experiences in the lived experience for a lot of our patients, and the coping that happens as a result of that. And a lot of people can point to the sense that they've been made to feel unhappy about their body size that becomes the underlying thread to all of this. And just getting to a smaller body size doesn't necessarily change your unhappiness with your body size when you've had that experience for a long time.
We are going to do a really deep dive into pharmacotherapy, which I am obsessed with, as I'm sure you are, because it's the hottest, most interesting thing. But you also are doing surgery. Can you tell me a little bit more about that and the state of that world right now?
The nice thing about having an integrated treatment program is that if that patient needs additional assistance with achieving their health goals, meeting their weight goals, then in surgery alone is not doing it, we can get them support with the medical treatment team. Surgery is still our most effective tool, especially when we talk about more severe disease, more complicated disease. And we know that the durability is there. We can do surgery safely. Side effects, adverse events are very low. We now compare it to your gallbladder taken out or having an appendix taken out, right? It's not the same thing that it was when people were doing open laparotomies in the 90s. So a very different world these days.
15 years ago, I was at Lutheran General Hospital in Chicago and helped them open their bariatric clinic. They started doing surgeries. And so it was dietitian, me, and all the doctors and the behavioral health team. But things have changed since then.
15 years ago, we were still doing bands.
Yeah.
That was the hot thing. We were putting in these laparoscopic adjustable gastric bands and thought that was going to be the efficient way to help people lose weight. And now we're taking them out because of the complications and the lack of effective long-term weight loss. I think we've moved on past that era, but we've got development of these newer procedures. We're starting to see an increase in the number of endoscopic procedures where you can take a endoscope, go down into the stomach and do an endoscopic sleeve gastrectomy that gets you really good treatment result. And that can be really a great procedure, especially for people who are high risk for anesthesia, for full-blown surgical procedure.
What kind of clinical research are you excited about in this space?
We've got a lot of really cool things happening in the clinical research space. You've got development and learning more about how the brain controls energy intake and the distribution of body fat, like we were talking about earlier, really being able to understand the idea of inflammation in the brain being a real problem that sets off a lot of this, and being able to see that on functional MRI scans or other types of imaging. And then there's a lot of interesting work happening, obviously, in the GLP-1 space and understanding how GLP-1s have a role in affecting energy intake and how we think about food, and maybe even on other areas like reward and memory and kidney and heart. And, you know, so GLP-1 has become this sort of like, this might be the molecule that saves us all. But we're on the pharmacotherapy side actually doing the only long-term study that's been done on the drug phentermine. Phentermine, it's the oldest anti-obesity medication we have, approved in the 50s, 1959, before the FDA had all of these sort of rigorous standards about what is required to get a drug to market. And it's been around all this time and still is one of the most highly prescribed anti-obesity medications we have. It's generic. And we find that it can be very effective for a lot of people, but there's a lot of misperception about it, and largely that's because there aren't a lot of good, high-quality data out there about it. And so we were fortunate enough to be able to get some funding from NIH to support a clinical trial where we're recruiting 900 people across 4 centers in the U.S. to study long-term treatment. So we're treating people with placebo or phentermine for 2 years. and we're looking at the outcomes related to both body weight and blood pressure. It's really exciting for us because going back to this sort of idea of disparities in health equity, we see this as an opportunity to say, look, we can actually treat more people with an effective therapy that's low cost, right? This is $10 a month versus what we see in some of our newer meds that are 100 times that cost.
That is really interesting. I would love to see the results of that study. It'll be out in a couple of years.
We're going to finish recruitment this fall, and then we got a couple of years after that to finish that up.
Wow. I bet a lot of people are excited to be enrolled.
Yeah, it's really been quite an interesting study. We quickly came to the realization that a lot of people do want to enroll in this type of trial because they can't get any other type of treatment. It's out of reach, it's not covered. And this, for a lot of people, is a great initial sort of treatment option to begin their journey towards health.
And it's not a big surgery, and it's not even injecting yourself. It's just taking a pill. And you also participate in a few professional organizations, and those organizations and yourself are helping lead the conversation about research in obesity. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, so I have the pleasure and honor of being the president for the Obesity Society this year. And we think of it as a leading organization for developing the science behind what we know about and how we think about obesity. So I like to explain to people, Obesity Society meetings are meetings that you come to learn why you're doing the things that you're doing. It's comprised of anybody involved in the care of the patient with obesity. And more, we're also incorporating and integrating the patient voice and lived experience in what we do. But education is another big part of what we do. As a professional society, what we're trying to do is help bring along people who also have an interest in this space and develop the next generation of leaders and scientists and people who will spread the word and create accessible information for people about this really challenging disease, that we're entering a really sort of exciting chapter in terms of where things will go. But it's a great organization. I've been really fortunate to have the chance to be involved, and this has been an exciting year for sure.
Yeah, congrats. I love that kind of leadership. What you're really highlighting for me is how exciting this field is right now, how dynamic. And also, I hope it helps people realize we have to get away from being like, move more and eat less. It's so simple. I'm still hearing that all the time, but it's so much more complex, and we need personalization. We need to look at people as individuals. On the medical side, how do you suggest healthcare practitioners add that level of personalization? Like, where do we go with our patients?
Yeah, this is a really important point that you're raising. How do we go from this generic, broad, often less than helpful advice to something that is actually meaningful at the individual level? Certainly clinicians are in the position to do that best because they're not trying to treat everybody in the world. They're trying to work with the person who's right in front of them. And so that solution can be a little bit easier. It goes back to what we were talking about first, is let's listen to the patient first. Let's hear them and understand their experience and validate that, because let's be honest, if we have a patient who says, I think I'm doing all the things I need to do in terms of I'm eating right, I feel like I'm exercising the way I need to exercise, I'm, you know, what's the problem? Why can't I lose weight, or why am I gaining weight? A lot of people will automatically discount that and say, you must be doing something wrong. And that's where the blaming piece starts to come in, right? And so the first step is we have to accept at face value what the patient is telling us and say, okay, I agree with you. I understand that. Let's start from where you are. And then let's figure out what we can do differently. So it's not that you've done something wrong, but we know what you're doing and we're here in this spot and we know we need to get over to the other spot. So continuing to do the same thing is not going to get us there. We've proven that.
Yeah.
So now let's figure out what we can do differently. And that becomes part of the partnership. When you're working with your clients, you're not prescribing exactly eat this at this time and that time. You're not dictating, but it's a negotiation. it's a sense of, based on my professional experience and knowledge and understanding of what's going on, here are the things that I think could make a difference for you. And then you have to tell me, based on my life and my resources and my sense of confidence about being able to do something different, here's what I think I can do. And that's where we get into the personalization of that. But my job as a clinician is to narrow the field of choices to the things that I think make the most sense for that person that's in front of me based on the data that I have. So I'm not going to recommend surgery to you if I know that the chances of you being successful with that are very slim based on what I understand about your case. It would be irresponsible of me to do that. I want to give you a set of choices that will give you the best chance to be successful. And then you have to decide in that set of choices, does that make sense? If it doesn't, you need to tell me why it doesn't. And then I can adjust from there.
It really becomes a partnership when you look at it that way.
Yeah.
I see a lot of people that come to me for weight or any other health concern because they're so frustrated with all the conflicting advice and everyone giving them opinions about what to do. And when you say that you're going to narrow the options of, okay, who are you? What do you need? What's going to help you the most? Let's discuss this together. That really is the most helpful thing that I've seen with patients.
And I think we're getting smarter about that. So right now, we use our clinical experience and our pattern recognition, and we analyze the labs and we look at the history and we do the exam and we look at social determinants of health, and we put all that information together in our brain and we spit out some ideas and thoughts based on the assimilation of that information. But we're very quickly getting to a point where we're going to have more computing power. We're going to have better diagnostics. We're going to have more information that will actually give us a better prediction of what might work even better for you. And not just in terms of achieving the outcome, but avoiding things like side effects or making it easier for you to do the thing that you want to do. So that's one of the things that I try to explain to patients is the value of some of the treatments that we might have. It's not that they are dramatically better than one thing or another, but it might be that it's easier for you to implement it because of how your brain works or because of how you perceive the world or just your social situation or things like that. Take, for example, meal replacement. I'm a big proponent of meal replacement, but not because I think that there's something magical about the formulation per se, but I also recognize that for a lot of my patients, the ideal of being able to prep and prepare and pack breakfast and lunch and take it to work and then come home and cook a dinner that's really nice for everybody, that's a great ideal, but it's not happening, right? You just don't have the time. You don't have the space. You don't have the wherewithal to be able to do all of that and take care of yourself and your family and your full-time job and so forth and so on. And so the ideal of a meal replacement is that it just makes it easier for you to do the thing that you want to do because you've now cut the steps from 10 to 1, right? And so that's what I am thinking about and talking to patients about is let's, in this tailoring and matching to treatment, not what's just most likely to be effective, but what's easier for you to do, because that thing is the most likely thing to be effective if we've got the right type of treatment.
I tell my clients there's ideal and then there's real. And I also told one of my clients the other day, because she was telling me how bad she felt that she couldn't make her own granola and she bought store-bought granola. And I said, let me tell you right now, I only buy store-bought granola, just to be very honest. That's just where I'm at.
Yeah. Let's not get too caught up in trying to be perfect on those types of things. Yeah.
100%. So if somebody comes to you, you know, you're going to talk about maybe meal replacements or maybe surgery or maybe see my dietitian, but I'm guessing you're talking to a lot of folks about weight loss drugs, and we're going to do a deep dive into that. But if I am interested in a weight loss drug, what do I need to consider when I'm opening that conversation?
The first thing that you want to consider that we're going to talk about is that because this is a chronic disease, we are talking about long-term treatment, not just a short-term therapy. So that's the first consideration that I'm going to have everybody make. Are you in this for the long term? Because if it works for you to help you lose weight, then it's likely to help you with long-term maintenance of weight loss. We know that discontinuation of treatment increases the probability of weight regain. Plenty of clinical trial evidence shows people who discontinue, about 80% of those people will experience weight regain. And that average weight regain, depending on the treatment, could be complete to 2/3 of what was lost. So unless we know ahead of time, like you are the person who won't regain weight, then I'm going to encourage you to stay on the treatment long term. So that's the first consideration. The second consideration is what can you access? What can you afford? You might want to be on the latest and greatest, but if your health insurance plan doesn't cover it and you're not independently wealthy enough to pay out of pocket for it, then that will be out of reach. And so we're going to be limited to some other smaller set of options. And those smaller set, that older generation of medication, what I tend to call our first and second generation medications, they can be highly effective. Again, this comes back to the idea of matching treatment to the right person. The biggest difference between what we have in the newer third generation medications and what we have in our first two generation medications is that these newer meds are more effective for a broader group of people. So we're talking about 75 to 90% of people achieving 10% weight loss or more. You just have a higher probability of seeing significant weight loss with the newer med. That's a main consideration. What do you have access to? And then I think the last piece is what other things do you have going on that might impact your options for medication? So if you've got heart disease, then that takes phentermine off the table, for example. Or if you've got significant issues with your GI tract in terms of you've got dysphagia or bad reflux or you've got motility issues, then GLP-1s may not be the treatment option for you. Even though you're desperate or have your heart set on that, it may cause you more harm than a benefit. So those are the things that we're going to consider. But I would say those are the top three things that right out of the gate, we're going to have that discussion. Long-term treatment, what do you have access to? And what are the other things that are going on that may impact that choice that we have?
I want to do a really deep dive into these treatments. But what I'm hearing from you as a major takeaway is there is no one size fits all. It is not simple. It's incredibly complex. And we must provide people personalization as we listen to their lived experience and personal story.
Yeah. I could not have summed that up any better myself. That's why you're the host.
Our show is sponsored by Orgain and produced in collaboration with Large Media. That's L-A-R-J Media. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Good Clean Nutrition Podcast. To stay up to date on the latest podcast episodes, be sure to hit follow on your podcast app. And if you like this podcast, I'd love for you to let us know. You can rate and review this show on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, or you can give us a thumbs up on YouTube if you're watching right now. I'm Ginger Holton. You can find me online at gingerholtonnutrition.com. Thanks so much for listening.